And joining us right now on PMPnetwork.com is a legend in music. We have known her music for decades. She keeps coming out with new stuff, and it's great stuff. And you remember Jefferson Airplane, Jefferson Starship, The Great Society, ladies and gentlemen, the great Grace Slick. Welcome to the program.
Wow, that was quite an intro.
Thank you very much. It took me about a year and a half to come up with that and rehearse it and work it out. And I thought maybe I'd blow it and it would be all over. So how you doing?
Well, pretty good considering my age. Basically, you know, when you get old, you're slowly falling apart. So you take care of that as best you can and keep putting one foot in front of the other.
I know. I'm in the same category. You know, we're all doing the same thing.
Well,
I remember myself in the 60s, but I look in the mirror and there's a different person in the mirror.
I know. Isn't it weird? Because people usually do not recognize me because I have white hair now. Long white hair, no bangs, no big eye makeup, except occasionally if I have to do a Skype thing for the art world or something. But, you know, it's just I can walk around. Nobody knows who the hell I am.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, everybody knows the great Grace Slick from, you know, from Jefferson Airplane. And if we ran into that person, we'd recognize her. But, of course, all of us have aged since then.
Well, yeah, my daughter can, if she wears makeup and put on a black wig, look exactly like me. And she's got a friend now who actually does have very dark brown hair and bangs and the whole thing and lots of eye makeup. And she looks like me. She looks like a combination of me and Rick Ocasek. It's a little weird.
See, I can't put those two together. Now Rick is not exactly an attractive woman. So.
Well, no, but she's very thin kind of how it works there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, your daughter, is she musically gifted as well?
Yeah, she can. She just was never interested in it, but she can sing. And she was an actress for a while, and she can imitate anybody. Here's this little small blonde, and she can do James Brown better than anybody I've ever seen. And it's just weird looking at her doing it, because here's this little tiny blonde doing James Brown, you know.
That's kind of cool. Maybe she should do
it. It is funny.
So what does she do for work at this point?
Well, she's right now she's my assistant, and she's trying to finish up college. She's on and off. She'd work, and then she'd go to college some more, and then she'd work and go to... So she's being my assistant and going to college to get a... she has two more units to finish college, so it's pretty soon.
Any other children?
No. She lives with her boyfriend, whom I just love. He's just fabulous. They live in the suite over my garage. There's a kind of big suite over the garage, so they live up there. And we all hang out and try to entertain each other. Because we don't do it on purpose. It's just we're all born entertainers, you know. It's like, look at me, aren't I funny? So we do that with each other all the time. And he is very funny. He's done comedic work. He's not a stand-up, but he's done comedic work a lot, and boy, is he funny. So I'm having a good time, despite falling apart.
Hey, well, I understand about the falling apart part. Because unfortunately, we're not where we used to be.
No.
But I want to talk to you about some stuff from the past, though, before we get into the present.
Okay.
Because I was just a huge Jefferson Airplane and Jefferson Starship fan. Let's talk about Airplane first and the Great Society, which started the whole thing. Tell us a little bit about the West Coast band when it started and how you felt when songs like Somebody to Love and White Rabbit just took off and you guys became huge.
Well, just before Airplane, I was working as a model for a store called I. Magnans in San Francisco, and it was kind of hoity-toity and sold Dior and Chanel and all those people. So I'd put on these $10,000 outfits and wander around in the designer area of this store all day. So that's on your feet. You have to change your clothes about every 8 minutes because... You have to keep showing people different clothes.
Yep.
And I pretty much hated it. But at the time, my husband at the time, Jerry Slick, that's where I got that name.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real last name. We went to see Jefferson Airplane play at a small club called the Matrix in San Francisco. And I looked at them and I thought, okay, they only have to work for about 4 hours a night. two sets, and it looks like they're having way more fun, and they don't have to work as long. You can drink and smoke. You can do whatever you want. Looks like way more fun than I'm having. My mother was a singer. I can probably do that. You know, the attitude of youth. Oh, yeah, I can do anything. So my husband at the time and I, with his brother, Darby Slick, formed a band called The Great Society. And we would open for Jefferson Airplane at the Fillmore West. And their singer, who was also a dark-haired, low-voiced Norwegian, which is what I was leaving for Florida to have a baby and, you know, live amongst the trees and whatever. So Jack Cassidy asked me if I wanted to join the Airplane. And I mainly joined because of his bass playing. My God, is he a good bass player. So I said, yeah. And so I joined Airplane. And Starship was formed because sort of the beginning of it was a solo album by Paul Kantner called Blows Against the Empire. Real good album. And Jerry Garcia's on it, and Mickey Hart, and who else? Oh, yeah. David Crosby, Graham Nash, lots of people were on that. And that was sort of the start of Jefferson Starship, because Paul likes outer space stuff. So I don't care what you name it. You can name it anything. And that started it. That was it followed up by, let's see, was it Red Octopus? I don't know what. Paul and I did a couple solo albums, and then it got into Marty came back, and it was Jefferson Starship,
right?
Because we made a deal, not signed, but just kind of amongst each other, that you couldn't call it Jefferson Airplane unless all of us, the originals, were on it. And Jack Cassidy and Jorma Kaukonen, the lead guitar player, were in Scandinavia somewhere. We didn't even know where. They both loved speed skating, so they were over there speed skating for a year. That's why Paul and I did the solo albums. We were sort of waiting for them to come back, but they didn't want to. So we called it Starship instead.
Well, I got to tell you that first of all, that before we even get back to Starship, because I wanted to talk about one thing. The Great Society, one thing that you didn't mention, which I think is really interesting, is that, because I have that album that came out from the Great Society, and Darby Slick wrote Someone to Love, which was called at the time, not Somebody to Love, but Someone to Love,
yeah.
And also a White Rabbit. Those were actually Great Society songs that you brought over to Airplane with you, and they were huge hits.
Yeah, well, I wrote White Rabbit, and he wrote Somebody to Love, and I just sort of, you know, figured that those are a couple of good songs, and turned out they were real good songs. I'm still, you know, the thing about music business that's good is if you are a writer, if you write songs, you get royalties. So.
Exactly, and that and the White Rabbit, I understand, only took you about an hour to write.
Yeah, it was very fast. I don't know why. Some of them take a while, and you got to look at it and look at it. And some of them are fast. You know, it just that's the way it goes.
Now, I had to ask you a question because it was emailed to me. They wanted to know if White Rabbit, when you wrote it, were you under the influence of anything at all?
Let's see. When I was actually sitting at the piano writing it, I don't know. I don't remember because we didn't pay any attention to it. Drugs were just something that were going on, and I possibly had marijuana, possibly. I know I wrote it in the daytime, so there wouldn't have been any alcohol involved. So it beats me. I could have been marijuana. That's the only thing I can think of because I love Quaaludes, but they're a little rough to keep your concentration, you know.
Well, you know, Surrealistic Pillow in 67 was huge, and it put Jefferson Airplane into one of the best-known bands in the country.
Pretty
and you became one of the top female rock musicians ever, and with your beauty and your stage persona, you were the sex symbol for the era. Many of us think back on that time.
I didn't think of myself in those terms.
But as you look back at it, though, you were.
Okay.
Right?
If you say so.
Well, I say so, because I was a teenage boy back then, so I understand.
All right.
Believe me. But so this was really huge, and you just mentioned you skipped over to Jefferson Starship. And one of the songs on Jefferson Starship, and I told this to Marty Balin when I had him on the show, was one of my continues to be my favorite song of all time, Miracles. It's one of the most beautiful songs probably ever written.
Yeah. most people do like that song, and that's Marty's. And
yeah.
It is a lovely song, and it is kind of true, you know. If you think you can do it, or if you think it can be done, pretty much it can be done. It's your mind is very strong, and I wish I knew how to use it a little bit more on physical stuff, you know. But I can do it with emotional. I can literally change my mind if I'm thinking about something that isn't a lot of fun. I'll simply change my mind, either by picking up a book and reading it, or changing where I am. That helps. If you're sitting down in your living room, getting all sad and mopey and feeling sorry for yourself, get in a car and go somewhere. If you're in a car, get out of the car and go shopping. If you're shopping and you're miserable, go to a movie. If you're going in a movie and you're, you know, just simply change everything. Change your position, change your mind. So I can do that. I don't worry about financial stuff because my father was a banker, and he taught me, here's how you do it, very simply. And so that's what I do. So I don't get in trouble. I don't bounce checks. I don't do any of that stuff.
Mm.
So financial, I'm okay. Emotionally, yeah, but physically, I can't stand physical pain, and I can't take any of the painkillers. They don't work on me except morphine. And you can't get morphine, so
yeah.
I'm pretty much screwed in physical pain.
Yeah.
But what Marty, I think, is talking about, he, you know, it's a love song, but it's also a real good thing to think about. If you believe you can do it, you can. It'll happen. So it is, in that sense, I think, a really good song.
I think it's, you know, I think all you need is someone to pluck your body like a string.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
So now Jefferson Starship then became Starship. What happened? Why did they drop the Jefferson on that?
Those are legal moves. I guess with Jefferson Starship, because the maybe members of the group had changed or something. I never pay much attention to names of groups, mine or anybody else's. You want to change your name? Fine. You don't want to change your name? Fine. Who cares? It's the music I'm sort of more interested in than names.
Were you a fan of the Starship music? We Built the City, Sarah, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, that kind of stuff?
No. Yeah. Don't like the 80s Starship. Now, we had 3 number one singles. But I'm really not interested in that. I'm interested in songs that have unusual or very personal. Like, I'd prefer to sing songs I write because I believe it. If I sing something like Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, I don't believe that. So I don't like singing songs I don't believe. And one of the dumbest songs ever, and Rolling Stone agrees with me, is We Built the City on Rock and Roll. What city? There's no city built on rock and roll. It's too new. And it was written by a British guy, okay? And he's usually a very good lyricist, and that's Bernie Taupin.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Taupin said, We Built a City on Rock and Roll. He's talking about L.A. Okay, there's a British guy talking about L.A. sung by a group from San Francisco. So all three of those cities, L.A. is built on oranges, oil, the movie industry. San Francisco is built on trade, gold, you know, and London was built by the Romans like 2,000 years ago. So, you know, what are you talking about? What do you mean we built this city on rock and roll? So it's kind of, and it's kind of sounds braggy when you sing it. We built this city on rock and roll. Who's we? What, your group built this? You know, so I hated that song. It was embarrassing to sing. Jane, whatever that was, is, you know, moronic. So, no, I didn't like it, but I was trying to be good girl because I'm this big drunk, you know, and I'd get arrested and do all kinds of dumb shit. So this, I was trying to be, yes, I'll do that song. Yeah, that's fine. You know, the producer would bring it. Well, he wanted to make money, and he wanted the record to sell, and it did. So apparently, you know, during the 80s, a lot of stuff during the 80s I didn't like. It's the worst fashion decade pretty much ever. So the 80s were a little tricky. I had a lot of operations on my knee, on my shoulders, and problems with a marriage, and, you know, it was just kind of, I'd rather not think about it. I was sober all during the 80s, but it wasn't a lot of fun. So.
I'm amazed. I could spend 8 hours talking to you because there is so much amazing stuff in here that I wanted to ask you about. Let's go into the stuff that people out there will be astounded by. Number one, Janis Joplin was a personal friend of yours.
Well, yeah. The problem was we all got famous kind of at the same time. So when that happens, all you're doing is you're on the road, you're making records, you're making videos or whatever. At the time, we weren't making videos because that's too early. But you're really busy. And so the only people you really see are the band and your own crew. But before that, for a couple of years, we both played together a lot. You know, Grateful Dead and Janis and the Airplane and Charlatans and so forth.
Right.
And so we saw each other backstage a lot. But not, we really didn't hang out. But we did see each other a lot backstage. And I love women from Texas. They're funny, they're strong, they're great to hang out with. And so I really enjoyed her company. And she's a big drunk like me, so.
Yeah, well, especially back then. Yeah, and of course, you were on the road and became friends in more ways than one with Jim Morrison from The Doors, too.
Yeah, well, he's gorgeous. He's like Johnny Depp. You know, you just look at him and go, oh my God in heaven. So I had one evening, or day, actually it was daytime, morning with him. And when I left, I said, well, you know, give me a call if you feel like it. And he never called, so probably I'm a terrible way.
I know you got married a couple of times, and of course,
Slick and Skip Johnson. I was married to Skip Johnson for 18 years.
Yeah, and of course, Paul Kantner, you had China with Paul.
Yeah, but I wasn't married to Paul.
No. But that's just the personal stuff. I wanted to get in some other interesting stuff, too, because David Crosby called you the Chrome Nun. What was that? And I know that you actually named one of your albums.
We called Paul Baron von Tolbooth. He had nicknames for his friends, and because Paul is German, his name is Paul Kantner, and he has very rigid posture, stands up and sits up very straight, because he went to a military school, so they trained him to do that,
mm-hmm.
And he called him Baron von Tolbooth, just being funny, called me the Chrome Nun. I think it's because when I write music, I am preaching. I'm kind of preachy about here's what ought to be done and here's what shouldn't, political stuff. And I never did David Crosby, so maybe that's the reference to the Chrome Nun. But I thought it was funny when he first did it, so we named one of our solo albums Baron von Tolbooth and the Chrome Nun.
Now, there was a story going around that in 1969, you were invited to a tea party at the White House because his daughter, I guess, went to school at the same school you did.
Richard Nixon's daughter went to the same school that I did 10 years later. She's younger than I am.
All right, Tricia.
But it's such a small school. It's a finishing school. It's really dumb. I just wanted to go to New York. I wasn't interested in learning anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't say to your parents, can I have $15,000 to go to New York and hang out for a year? They'd say no. So you go to the easiest college you can find. They teach you how to, you know, which fork to use for the salad and how to sit. You know, ladies should never sit with their legs crossed at the knee. It's always at the ankle. Stuff like that. They teach you how to get a Princeton boy or a Yale guy or Harvard or something, which is what we did on the weekends. We'd go up to Princeton. You know, it's one of those kind of schools. So apparently Tricia Nixon went there. What she did was invite all the alumni from Finch College to a tea at the White House. But when I was at Finch, my name was Grace Wing, W-I-N-G. That's my maiden name.
Mm-hmm.
Good name for Jefferson Airplane, but I was married by then, so it's slick. But it wasn't slick. So they didn't question sending me an invitation. It's just some woman named Grace Wing. And I got the invitation, and I thought, ooh, I think I have to call Abbie Hoffman and have him go kind of as like my boyfriend or husband or something. And because when it finally came time to go, we were standing in line in front of the White House, going through security waiting to get in, all these ladies who had gone to Finch College and their husbands or boyfriends. Security comes up to me, he said, I'm sorry, you can't go in. I said, oh, but look, I have an invitation. And he said, no, but you're a security risk. And I thought, well, he's right, but he doesn't know why. Because I had about 600 mics of acid in my pocket and a very long little fingernail for cocaine. So what I was planning on doing is, having been taught what formal teas are at Finch College, I knew that they, you stand, you don't sit. You stand and wander around, talk to people. And so I could just simply be gesturing, talking to Richard Nixon across his teacup and let 600 mics of acid go into the teacup. And he wouldn't have known the difference because you can't taste it. And about half an hour later, he would have been wandering around acting really loony and asking why the walls were moving, you know. So, but it didn't happen because they wouldn't let me in. They didn't say anything to Abby Hoffman. Abby Hoffman is one of the Chicago Seven.
Right.
And they didn't say a word to Abby. So, and he looked just terrible because we were trying to make him look like a regular person, but he's got this really curly black hair. We tried to comb it back, put a suit on him. He looked like somebody from a mafia. So but nobody even looked at him. So it was me they didn't want in there. I was sort of disappointed, but Richard Nixon got himself out later, and he used to wander around and talk to the pictures of the presidents in the White House anyway. So he was screwy anyway, got himself out. I didn't have to.
You actually, in your biography, kind of mentioned a few times about getting arrested for, it wasn't even drunk driving, it was kind of like drunk talking.
Yeah, because I've never been in a car. I've been arrested for drunk driving 3 times, but I've never been in a car.
Yeah.
The cars always come to a stop.
Once it was on fire.
And then the cops either show up or because somebody calls them. Like one time I was arguing with Paul. We were driving home in San Francisco, and he didn't want to argue anymore. So at a stop sign, I was driving, and he took the keys out of the ignition and threw them out the window onto somebody's lawn. So obviously the car, he gets out of the car and starts walking down the street, or running down the street, get away, he didn't want to argue. So I'm on this person's lawn on my hands and knees looking for the keys to the car, and I look over to the side, and I see the navy blue pants and this shiny shoes, and I just started laughing because I knew it was cops. And they said, what's so damn funny? And I said, well, I kind of knew I was going to get arrested when I saw your pants. Mm. And they took me down to jail. But see, I wasn't in the car. It was obvious that I was drunk. Another time, I was in a big black pickup truck parked up in back of a woodsy area in Marin County. And I was out of the car, sitting down, leaning up against a tree, reading and drinking wine. Excuse me. Hang on. So, there's nobody up there. Squirrels, deer, trees. Cop comes by the road, gets out, says, what are you doing? So what does it look like I'm doing? See, I always start in on cops, and it's just stupid. And he said, don't get smart or something like that. I said, I'm reading a book. I'm having some wine, I'm having a little lunch, and I'm sitting under a tree. And he said, well, stand up. You can't drink in public. And I said, public? You've got deer, you've got squirrels, you're the only public that's here. Took me to jail. Another time I was driving about 125 miles an hour in an Aston Martin. The light on the oil gauge had gone out. There was no oil. All of a sudden, the car bursts into flames. I pull over, get out of the car about 50 feet away from it because I thought it was going to explode. This is on a freeway in Northern California. Got Volkswagen comes by. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. Says, you want me to call the highway patrol? And I said, please. So the highway patrol comes. Guy gets out of the car. Big beer guy puts his thumbs in his belt and said, okay, what's going on here? And I said, well, I'm a woman alone at 3 o'clock in the morning. My car's on fire. What the fuck does it look like's going on here? I go to jail. But see, all three of those, I've never been in a car. But it's they don't like being spoken to like that. Mm. And that's what used to amuse me. I'm not quite the same anymore. I don't do that. It's very expensive. You have to hire lawyers to get out of jail and all that kind of stuff.
And that, well, nowadays with the TMZ on the scene all the time, you'd be on the news every day.
Oh, yeah, they didn't have any of that kind of stuff then.
Yeah. Now, you actually, you know, we kid about you drinking, but you did have a problem, and you've gone to rehab a few times. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know you've written about it. And
I'm the original Lindsay Lohan.
Exactly. But, you know.
So was Janice. So were actually most of us, because at the time, that was just part of what you did. I mean, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That was the deal.
Hmm.
Today it's tougher on the kids because it's not, when you're an actress, it's a little different because you have to get bonded by an insurance company for motion pictures if you make trouble. Like, insurance companies have to do a number on whoever's putting on the movie if they hire Lindsay Lohan, because mm-hmm. she might get drunk or she might take off or she might do this, that, or the other thing. Paris Hilton doesn't matter. She's her own. She doesn't do movies, and it doesn't really matter. It might upset her parents. It might impact her businesses. So what? And but it's a little different now than it was then. I'd get in trouble. Maybe I'd make the People Magazine or San Francisco Chronicle newspaper or something. But they didn't have TMZ.
Exactly. Now, tell us a little bit about your art, too. I know that after you left music, that you started doing art, and I remember actually one of your paintings was the cover of, it was the Best of Hatunas cover, right?
Yeah, I think I did a CD cover for Hatuna, and they decided to make a poster out of it and blow it up. Well, you can't do that with something that's drawn that small, because the color separates. The bigger you blow it up, the more it separates, and there's all these white dots all over the place. So the poster looked awful as far as I was concerned. But yeah, and I used to do some drawing of the inserts in albums. We used to put little booklets in the record albums, and I'd do some, you know, pencil drawing or pen drawing or something. And when I stopped doing music, I studied biomedical research fraud for 4 years, and I'd go on the television and argue about screw-ups and how unscientific, not humane, but unscientific animal research is.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only reason I started drawing is I did a book, I think it's called Somebody to Love?
A rock and roll memoir. Yep.
Yeah, and the book agent came over to my house to talk business, and she said, oh, I didn't know you drew, and whoa, you ought to do some pictures for the book of rock and rollers. And I said, that's too corny. Rock and roll draws rock and roll, isn't that cute? And I really wasn't very interested, but I said, oh, okay, I'll do two. I'll do, I don't know, I think it was Garcia and Hendrix. And I realized when I started drawing other rock and roll people, I really liked it because they had interesting personalities, and they were not all blondes with long legs and big boobs. You know, it wasn't like that. We actually had different faces and different bodies,
mm-hmm.
so it makes it a little more interesting for somebody to draw that. So I actually got so I like doing that, and sometimes that's what I do now, and people like white rabbits, and I do animals, and one I'm working on right now is a cartoon. It's like a cartoon. So it just sort of took off from then. My accountant introduced me to my agent, who is still my agent. So I've been doing gallery shows and Skype and what have you for a long time. Not the Skype for a long time, but gallery shows.
Now, if folks want to see your artwork, what website would they go to for that?
Area, A-R-E-A. Arts, A-R-T-S, .com.
AreaArts.com, okay. And I understand they can get, like, autographed stuff and some good stuff on that website, right?
Well, it's better to see things in person, but if you, you know, nobody's going to buy a $35,000 painting from seeing it on a computer, unless, of course, it is well-known. If they see, and they've got a whole bunch of money, and they see Van Gogh or something on the computer, then obviously you can buy it, but not so many people are going to buy art on a computer, but you can see some of the stuff.
Yeah. And it also lists your shows so they can go see it in person.
Yeah, except the shows now are Skype because I can't fly. I wish I could, but I can't because of a foot thing.
Uh-huh.
It's very rare, and they don't know anything about it, the medical profession. So when I go on an airplane, my feet just blow up like crazy. What it is called erythromelalgia, and if my feet get over about 62 degrees Fahrenheit, feels like somebody poured boiling water into them. They turn bright red, and if I'm on an airplane, it does all of that, and they get puffed up to about the size of an elephant. It's really not good.
Can you wrap them up in some kind of heating pads?
Pardon?
Can you wrap them in some kind of heating pads to keep them warm?
Heating pads?
Or cooling, something to cool them off then?
Right now, where I'm sitting, where I draw, there are four air conditioners aimed at my feet.
So you can put, how about cooling things? They have those cool packs you can put.
Yeah, my feet are so hot that those, I can turn those into neutral in about 1 minute.
Wow.
So there isn't, like you can get heated socks. Heating is easier, than cold. To get something very cold on its own, and it's lasting, and it stays cold, like a refrigerator or something, they're big units, so that there's no way you can do that. When I go to movies, I have to take fans for my feet, and it's kind of embarrassing, and you can't see because it's dark, so it's a big pain in the butt. But it's very rare, so not that many people have it, which means they won't study it, because if they do figure out something to help it, there's only about 300 people or 300 to 500 people in the world with this thing.
Mm.
So they wouldn't make any money off it, so they don't study it.
That's a shame.
They don't know what causes it. They don't know how to cure it. There's no demographic. Some people are old. Some people are young. Some are women, men, drinkers, non-drinkers, smokers, non-smokers. There's no, you can't pinpoint anything on it. So there's that.
Now, let's go back to your activism, because it's going to lead into what we want to talk about. But right after 9-1-1, you were outspoken about it. Do you have any opinions about the proposed mosque being built at Ground Zero?
Yeah, the country, unfortunately, for some people who don't like it, this country's free country. So they should be able to build a mosque. It is not, it's like blaming all Christians for the Inquisition. Yes, the people who did it are abominable, but you can't label all Christians evil because of the Inquisition. Same thing with the people who did that are not, there's a lot of Muslims who say that's just terrible. Because they're not freaks. They're Muslim. They're not freaks. These people who did that are freaks.
But
and
you still think
radical,
that...
And any radical sect of a religion is going to be goofy and deadly. There's more people killed in the name of their religion than any other reason.
That's true. The problem that people have with it is not that they're building it, but that they're building it at Ground Zero, and it's disrespectful to the people who passed away there.
Well, it's not at Ground Zero. It's a couple blocks away, and so are strip clubs and other weird things.
Mm-hmm.
It's New York. It's a free country. They ought to be able to build their mosque. If you don't like it, then don't go there. It's the same way as people who are bigots. If you don't like white Christians, then don't hang out with them. If you don't like black people, don't hang out. You don't have to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't go there. There's plenty of stuff I don't like, so I don't go there. It's real easy.
Now, let me ask you a question. You're from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
What brought your interest over to Louisiana? Obviously, they've had the hurricane. They had a BP oil disaster. What is it that attracted your attention and got you so passionate about the whole subject?
Well, the lack of assistance from the federal government annoys the bejesus out of me. You know, we're spending all this money going over to the Middle East to try and set them up the way we're set up. They don't want to. For thousands of years, they've been fighting each other and wearing burqas and doing whatever they do. They don't, They haven't come over here except 9/11, but they haven't ever come over here and said, here's a, we want you to do this kind of government. We want you to be a theocracy. We'd go bat, you know, if they did that. So you don't go to people and tell them how to operate. They don't like it. We wouldn't like it. They don't like it. So get out of the Middle East. We should be really fast turning our energy around windmills and whatever, you know, to avoid having to deal with the Middle East. If they want to live like that, kill each other, go ahead on.
Yeah, I'm in the same category as you in terms of the Iraq and Afghanistan stuff. We need to bring our soldiers home.
Yeah, and so what I thought was, get them out of the Middle East, bring the soldiers home, and have them go help in the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing killing people when we need those guys down in the Gulf Coast? You got to clean it up. Okay, they're all excited. We capped it. Yeah, but look at the mess you left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the mess that New Orleans still has. So the song is called The Edge of Madness that a friend of mine and I wrote. And she did most of the work, you know, calling people and getting the band together. And Bill Medley from the Righteous Brothers is on the end of it, and a whole bunch of other people singing back up, me included. She's singing the lead. I wrote the lyrics, and she wrote the music. And we're selling this CD, trying to raise money to give to the fishermen and some musicians in the Gulf Coast, because apparently the government isn't going to do anything, so you know, various private citizens are trying to do something. Now, the government, hopefully, is going to sue BP, because you can't behave like that, you know, and we shouldn't be having to deal with oil anyway. They say, well, we don't do that much in the Middle East. We get all our own oil. Yeah, but we apparently don't know how to manage it.
Mm.
You know, if you screw up, you got to clean up your own mess.
I wanted to let people know that actually the song can be downloaded, The Edge of Madness can be downloaded at the Grammy Museum's website, which is GrammyMuseum.org, and that money will go toward the Greater New Orleans Foundation's Gulf Coast Oil Spill Fund, right?
Yeah, and it's a real good idea, because apparently the government is a little loose on taking care of those people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're in terrible times right now anyway, and then on top of it, the people in New Orleans have to put up with being hammered by everything and not very much help.
Now, how did you hook up with Michelle Mangione?
Well, she's several years ago, she's a friend of a friend, and we were just introduced that way, and she's a musician. She's really good.
Is she related to Chuck at all?
She can write. She can record her own stuff. She can do machinery. She's just amazing.
Is she related to Chuck?
No.
No?
And she has recorded some stuff that's amazing sound in her bedroom. I mean, she set it all up herself, and it's just, I just love working with her, because she's really good at what she can do, and fast. So the song, Edge of Madness, is New Orleans. It's you know, Creole kind of music. And apart from Dr. John, not many people hear that kind of music, bio kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting for them to hear it, because it's different. If you like Britney Spears, you're probably not going to like this.
Now, most of the recording was done in her bedroom studio, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
Or she'd just take recording equipment, as she did with me, and bring it over. And I'd sing into this stuff, and then she'd pack it all up and go.
Yeah. Well, she did that with a lot of people.
A lot of stuff
yeah.
like that now, which yeah. is really fabulous. You know, we recorded in studios, and you have to rent the studio, and so she didn't have to rent anything.
I wanted to give credit where credit is due here, because you mentioned Bill Medley from the Righteous Brothers.
Yeah.
But Tom Dumont from No Doubt, Billy Zoom from X, Martha Davis from the Motels, Kid Ramos from the Fabulous Thunderbirds, Larry Hansen from Alabama, Terry Nunn from Berlin, and Steve Hodges from Tom Waits Band and Smashing Pumpkins were also involved.
Yeah.
So
everybody jumped right on it. She called them up, said, do you want to do this? And they said, oh, yeah, because everybody has that idea and knows that they are not getting help down there, the help they need, and that they have been hammered either by nature or by human error. So they know that it just keeps coming at them. And New Orleans, that Gulf Coast is an amazing amalgam of different cultures, you know, French and Creole and African and you name it. And it came out. The food is fantastic. Bourbon Street is just amazing. You can go walk down the street and you can almost climb in a window and just listen to the music for a while. And great, like I said, great food, just great people. And there's all that gree-gree and juju, you know, stuff going on. It's fascinating. I love New Orleans.
It is. Now, have you been out? I know you're obviously having health problems, but are you planning at any point, even locally, of performing?
No, I don't really perform anymore. I just did the... Michelle just dragged the microphone over here and I sat back up, but I don't do music anymore because let's say you want to make a record. Well, you have to go on the road to promote it. Record companies don't just sign you up and say, well, why don't you just sit in your living room and make a record and then we'll, or CD, obviously, or a computer. What I do is one thing at a time. And now I paint.
Right.
So that's pretty much all I do. I can draw, and I've done, I did an album cover once, I think, or twice, and some inserts in record albums. But for the most part, I do one thing at a time. Jerry Garcia used to take his paints on the road.
Yeah.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
If I'm on the road, that's what I'm doing. It's music.
Yeah.
One man at a time, one child, one house, one car. I don't have a lot of stuff. Because why do I need a lot of stuff? I'm amazed at people who have like a house here and then another house over there and another house. You know, it's a lot easier to stay in a hotel. You don't have to keep track of everything and pay for maids and pay for people to keep your house going and never know if something's working. Well, we're coming. You know, you call your house in France and say, well, we're coming, so fix it up. You got to pay a whole bunch of people to fix it up because you're... It's so much easier to stay at the George Sank. It's so much easier to stay at a Holiday Inn if you don't have any money, you know?
Well, or you can hang with Grace Slick and her daughter and her boyfriend and hang out there at the house.
Well, well, you can... So I live here, and when I was able to be on an airplane, I stay in a hotel, and I don't want another house to think about and keep track of and pay for. You just have a house. And then you take airplanes and stay in hotels, and it's fun to stay in a hotel. You don't have to cook. You got room service. You got people making your bed. Hey, it's great.
Well, Grace, it was more than a pleasure for me to talk to you today. I really enjoyed it, and we're going to send some folks down to your website, and we'll also send them over to the GrammyMuseum.org to listen and hopefully download.
GrammyArts.com and GrammyMuseum.org.
And we'll send people over there to listen to The Edge of Madness, and hopefully the government will get a clue and start being prepared for disasters when they happen. Thank you so much for coming on, Grace. It was a pleasure for me to talk to you.
Thank you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.